Thank you, everyone, for coming. My name is Mindy Schwartzelty. That's all the bio that we need. Okay, so you press play on that? Okay, yeah, I am in GPATS, yes.
And in Revel.
And in Revel, and yes, aspiring scholar, I wouldn't say a scholar. it's a graduate program in Just Studies at YU. So let's get started. Our topic today is Majority Rules, the Fundamental Debate Behind Lo Bashamayimhi, which translates into It Is Not in Heaven. It's a pasuk in the Torah. Basically, Moshe is telling the people that the Torah, it, Lo Bashamayimhi, so that he is the Torah. It's not in heaven. It's on the earth. Okay? So the end, kind of where we want to land here, is a very exciting, really jam-packed Gemara in Bava Metzia. The story is called Tanur Shel Achnai, which translates into the oven of snakes, and when we get there, we'll understand why it has that very weird name. So we want to get there, and we want to understand the really complex and interesting debate that's happening in that Gemara, but in order to get there, we have to do a little bit of grunt work. Let's not call it grunt work, that's a very negative connotation. A little bit of backstory in order to appreciate the really interesting, very fundamental debate, as I called it, that's happening in that Gemara. So let's take it step by step so that we can really appreciate the Gemara once we get there. So the first step is to understand majority rules as a legal principle. So we kind of understand it sort of logically. If you're sitting at a table and you're deciding, should we play Monopoly for after dessert or should we play Risk? And you take a vote. You know, that's just like what we, I guess maybe because we live in a democracy or just because it's a logical thing, we just decide, okay, we're going to take a vote. And if three people want Risk and five people want Monopoly, we're going to play Monopoly because the majority rules. It's a common thing that we say sort of in a day-to-day life. And interestingly, it's actually a principle, a legal principle that Chazal, the sages, used to determine the halacha. So it's not just a thing that we say in order to determine things and make things easier for us or how we determine the president, sort of, or things like that. But actually, it really applies as a fundamental legal principle to Chazal. So let's understand how we arrive at that legal principle, because you might think that it's actually not so intuitive. Why do you have to follow the majority? What if the majority is wrong? Then should you be following the majority? So maybe we should follow someone who's, we should follow the smartest person. We should follow the oldest person because they have the most experience. There's a lot of other, I think, ways that you can go about determining something without saying majority has to rule. There actually, in America, is a fear of sort of the mob, the majority sort of becoming a mob or the... It's a little bit derogatory the way that the founders kind of formulated, but it was sort of like the low, uneducated masses. So there is even a fear of maybe the majority is not right because they're not informed. So how do we get this principle of majority rules? We have to derive it from somewhere. Okay, so we're gonna start with source one in Shemot Chaf Gimel Bet. So you have this very interesting pasuk. It says, Lo tia achrei rabim lara'ot, v'lo t'ana al riv l'atot, achrei rabim lahatot. Okay, so we have this. You really didn't miss anything, so.
Yeah,
you're good. Okay, so this is going to be the source for majority rules. And in a second, you'll realize why that is a very weird thing for me to say. Because the literal, let's say, pshat translation of this pasuk is Lo tia achrei rabim lara'ot. Don't go after the majority for bad. So you're like, it kind of reminds me of like high school where like, there's all the kids are picking on someone and you're like that one kid that like knows the right thing to do. And he's saying, don't just go after the majority of kids that are picking on the other kid because they're the majority. You don't want to stand out. You don't want to, make a wave. You just want to blend in. Don't do that because the majority is going, in a bad direction. You should stand up. So the first part is actually telling us go against the majority when the majority is for bad. Then we have Lo tana al riv l'atot. So don't, give perverse testimony so that we go after the majority. Achrei rabim lahatot. So that lo also goes on achrei rabim lahatot. Don't go after the majority. So if you'd read this pasuk and I didn't tell you that this was the source for majority rules, I'm guessing you would never have read this pasuk and thought it was the source of majority rules, because it literally, and this is a good use of the word literally, not a superfluous use, it literally means the opposite. It literally means do not follow the majority. So how did it come to be that this became the source for majority rules? So first, I brought Rashi here. I already explained this as such, but Rashi, after bringing the drash, he brings the pshat after, and he says, "Ani omerli yeshivo afnav pshuto kach b'tirno." So when I want to, as Rashi, you know, proclaims himself as the pashtan, he translates things literally, which he doesn't always do, but he likes to think that he does. So he's, you know, going for it. He says, "I want to make this yeshivo afnav pshuto kach b'tirno. I want to make it sit on like the way that it literally or simply means." And he says it means basically, don't go after the majority for bad. That's the pasuk. So literally, it means do not go after the majority, probably in a situation where it's bad. Okay? But then we see in Chazal, we see that this pasuk is used in the exact opposite formulation. So I brought two gemaras which show how this pasuk is used as a source of majority rules against its literal meaning. So the first is in Sanhedrin, and the basic setup, I don't want to read this inside because I really want to read the whole Gemara at the end inside, so I want to save up our reading on the inside and I want to have enough time. So I'll just explain it outside. But basically, it sets up a problem in the pasuk. It says that, Achri Rabim Lara'ot, the first part, that teaches me that I can exonerate by a majority of one, but I can't convict. So it's making an assumption. L'ra'ot means to convict. For bad means that I'm saying, you, Joe, are guilty of stealing. That would be bad. That's l'ra'ot. So I can't do that by a majority of one. But maybe I can exonerate by a majority of one. So maybe if I'm saying, Joe, you didn't steal, then, let's say, instead of l'ra'ot, it would be l'hetiv, or, you know, for good, then I can go by the majority. But then they say, but the end of the pasuk says, achrei rabim l'hatot. So we seem to have a contradiction. That might indicate that actually we can also exonerate by a majority of, we can also convict by a majority of one. So what do we do with this seeming contradiction in the pasuk? We resolve it by saying that achrei rabim l'hatot means that you can exonerate by a majority of one. So Joe is innocent of stealing. That can be decided, 4-3, 5-4, whatever, majority of one. But Achrei Rabim Lahato teaches us that you can convict by a majority only of two. So if you're going to convict, it has to be a majority of two. Okay, so that's, here we have this pasuk, which again, we're going really according to, against the literal meaning. We're saying that it teaches us Achrei Rabim Lara'o means you rule by the majority to exonerate with one person, you rule by majority with two people to convict. So really disregarding the literal meaning of the pasuk. Now we're going to get even simpler. So that was about, you know, a case of exonerating, convicting. Where do we see just a general principle of majority rules? It's not always in a court case. Sometimes it's like majority rules, you know, I guess, I'll just use the Gemara's example because why would I have a better example than the Gemara? It's the Gemara. Okay, so let's look at the Gemara. So this is telling us that there's a general principle. It says, Minaha milta de amar rabbanan zil batar ruba minalan. So zil batar ruba is the way the Gemara formulates majority rules. So zil means go after, zil means go, batar means after, and ruba means the most or majority. So zil batar ruba, go after the majority. So where do we get that principle from? And he quotes, Dichtiv achrei rabim lahatot. So interesting. Really took it straight out of the pasuk, completely dropped it, you know, in a totally different meaning, took out the low, and just said, this is the source for going after the majority, achrei rabim lahatot, go after the majority. So that's how we see, we have, clearly, this is being used as the formulation for majority rules. They're on page 2 for the end of the Gemara, and it just clarifies that it's very obvious to us that this pasuk applies in cases where there is a known majority. So let me give you two examples as the Gemara gives. The first is, let's say you have a case of 10, it's called Tet Chaniot, but it's really 10, which means 9 stores, but it's really 10 stores, and 9 are kosher and 1 is not. And in that situation, if you found a piece of, let's say you have 10, you're on Main Street, that's a street, you're on Main Street here, that's like the place we'll have food. Okay, and there are 10 meat stores, I don't know how they all stay in business, but they do, and 9 of them are kosher, and 1 of them is not kosher, and you are on Main Street, and you see just kind of lying around a package of ground beef. Can you assume that ground beef is kosher? Any guesses?
You can.
You can?
No.
Why not?
Because there's one that isn't.
Okay, but how many are kosher?
But you're not doing statistics, no matter what.
Yeah, so this is what you're pointing out to is an critical fundamental point about majority rules. When you take that piece of meat, you actually can assume it's kosher. Maybe today they tell you it's not really like a hefseid, so you know, just be machmir on yourself. But actually the Gemara says you can assume that piece of meat is kosher because the majority of stores are kosher. And they're telling you that there is a fundamental principle that even though there is a 1 out of 10 chance that that piece of meat is not kosher, we define it as kosher for you. It's mutter for you. That's No, so I'm saying, so here's, that's, but that's kind of the crazy leap that majority rules.
It's okay, because Spartans say it's not okay. So don't worry, not say it's okay.
It's a heter, I find it.
I think that's a little anachronistic, but we're going to get to this later, the way that majority rules really like kind of fundamentally reinterprets things, but just even if it doesn't sit right and you wouldn't eat that meat, which is fine, I wouldn't eat that meat either just because I found on the street that's like I wouldn't eat it either, but just to understand the principle, it means that we're redefining this piece of meat. Even though it has a 1 out of 10 chance of being not kosher, we define it as kosher. That's how powerful majority rules is as a principle. So even if you disagree with it or you wouldn't eat it, whatever, just understand the power of the principle. So as long as we're on the same page about that. The second example is a case of a court case. Let's say Sam and Joe come. Sam says Joe owes him $100. Sam says whatever. You know, there's a monetary dispute. And two of the people on the three-person Beit Din say Sam owes the money and one person says he doesn't. Sam has to pay because majority rules. So what do we mean by known majority? So known meaning we know there are 9 kosher stores. Or we know there are 2 judges on this court who say that, you know, who say X or say Y. That's a known majority. Then they say, but there is a question when it comes to an unknown or unquantifiable majority. And I'll just give you the case that they bring and then we can kind of move on in our legwork to get to the Gemara. So the case that they bring, really fascinating case, called Katan and Ketana. So the case of Katan and Ketana is a minor who marries another minor for Yibam. Okay, so we're familiar with the rules of Yibam. You marry the brother dies without children. The other brother marries that wife in order to keep the brother's name. If they're not doing Yibam, that relationship is usur. Then a brother cannot marry his sister-in-law. So it's a forbidden relationship, it's arayot. But in the context of Yibam, it's not only permitted, it's required, unless you do chalitza, to get yourself out of it. So that's the thing with Yibam. And if the brother, the one who Yibam is required on, say the brother that's still alive, or the sister-in-law are infertile, they won't be able to have children, then there's no requirement of Yibam because they won't be able to do the point of Yibam. The point of Yibam is to have another child, and that child will keep the name of the brother who died. If you can't have a child, then you can't fulfill the purpose of Yibam, so there's no point in doing Yibam, and so it would be arayo for them to get married. So we have a case of a katan and ketana, 2 minors who get married for Yibam, and we don't know if one of them is infertile because they haven't reached puberty. How are we supposed to know if they're infertile or not? So should we really allow them to get married? Because if it turns out that they are not fertile, then it will be a riot. So there's a machloket in the Gemara, and basically the one side says we should be concerned that they're not fertile. The other side says the majority of people are fertile, so we rule like the majority. So how is that unquantifiable? We don't really know, you know, how many people are fertile, how many people are infertile. Maybe today we have a better idea statistics-wise, but it's an unquantifiable thing. We're just saying, we know from living in the world the majority of people are fertile. So that's what I mean by unquantifiable. But either way, even in this case where we have a little bit of doubt, we still say majority rules, most people are fertile, and we allow them to get married, even though there's a possibility of a riot. So again, just emphasizing and underscoring the powerful principle of majority rules. And just so we don't forget how we got here, it's really against the literal meaning of the Torah. Okay, so now that we got there, we need to give ourselves also some context for the people who are going to be involved in this dispute in the Gemara Bava Metzia that we're going to get to as our main focal point. So we're not really going to be able to appreciate this dispute, which is between the Chachamim and Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, unless we understand who Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is and what context their argument is in. So first, to understand the student, we must understand the teacher. I think that's a good principle. To understand, you know, where people's Torah is coming from. So let's talk about this, some context. So the context that we have here in this debate is Yavne. So I don't know if people have heard of Yavne, so I just gave some brief background. Yavne is founded by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So we see in Gemara and Sukkah, this is source 5, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is a student of Beit Hillel. He's actually apparently the worst student of Beit Hillel, so I guess I gave everyone some hope that even if you feel like you're behind in the class, you could still get to the top. You know, you could still make something of yourself. So he was actually the, it says the youngest, but it also says later that he was the worst. So, well, oh no, no, because katan can also mean worst. It doesn't have to mean youngest, so that's why. So Safari was just being nice. That's what happened. So he was possibly the worst student. And so he's carrying on basically Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai. This is, you know, a lineage of Misora. If you read that, you know, that first, I think it's the first Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, you know, Moshe gave the Torah to, whenever I was in Camp Misora, the Howe girls always had a song for that lineage, and it was, they knew it. It was very impressive. I didn't go to Howe, so I don't know it by heart. So, but we have this whole lineage, Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai are in that lineage, and we have student of Beit Hillel, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. We see in Gittin, this is a pretty well-known Gemara for Tisha B'Av time, when Vespasian comes and he's, you know, the siege around Yerushalayim, and they're destroying the, you know, the city, and it's terrible and sad, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai has to sneak out. I don't know if you guys are getting memories of, like, Mrs. Zoltan, you know, she, like, told us this whole story in a very fabulous way. Our Jewish history teacher in Central, very good at telling us the story of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and how there were these crazy zealots in the city. He had to escape in a coffin to go speak to Vespasian to end the siege and to, you know, just stop this because there was total terrible destruction in the city. And there's this very fantastical story where he basically predicts that Vespasian will be the emperor. And then right as he does that, a messenger comes and says, "You're the emperor, you're the emperor." So Vespasian is like, "Wow, you get 3 wishes." So, you know, whatever. Go to a different shir to find out if this is true or not. But let's just assume that's true. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai gets 3 wishes and 3, you know, requests. And the first thing he asks for is Yavne. So what is Yavne? Yavne is going to be the city where he keeps this line of Misora going, but not just keeps it, but actually reestablishes it. And we know that Yavne is a city that's known for innovating the Misora, especially post-Chorban, because the Misora needs to reshape itself in order to work for a Judaism that does not have a Beit HaMikdash. So we see Yavne as this, I wrote here, the center of halachic innovation. So in a lot of ways, Yavne is, you know, pushing the Misora forward, definitely, you know, keeping the Misora. Actually, the second thing he asked for is to keep the dynasty of Rabban Gamliel, which is supposed to be from David. So it's definitely a counterpoint. It's not, you know, innovative without any weight to it. He clearly cares about the Misora and the Shalshalet, but there's definitely also the spirit of innovation. We're going to see that even more when we look a little bit further on. So now that we understand the teacher, this is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the founder of Yavne, he's a great halachic innovator, he's a leader of the Chachamim. Now let's understand his student, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the Mishnah and Eva, this is source 7. So I titled this The Outsider Turned Traditionalist. So let's see how his personal history really fits that title. So first we see in Pirkei Avot, this is the bottom, and I think we're on page 2 right now. Source 7, so Mishnah Avot, that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai Chamisha Tamidim Hayulo, so he has 5 students, who list all students. The first one listed is Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. And if you go in the Gemara, 5 lines down, we get, it's this really cute thing where the teacher describes all of his students in nice metaphors, it's very sweet, and he describes Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus as follows. He says, Bor su she'eno ma'ave tipa. He's a plastered well that does not lose a drop of water. So what does that mean? I want to look at two passages in Avot Rabbi Natan to understand what that means. So it's a collection of Agadic sources. Very interesting. Actually, the Nesach that I brought in source 8 is not exactly like the Nesach that the Sefer that I saw. It's a little bit different. I think the Sefer that I saw is better, but Sepharia, alas, did not have it. And it was too long to ask my husband to type because I cannot type in Hebrew. He did type source 9 for us, so credit goes to him. I'll tell you outside the basic idea of this Avot Rabbi Natan, source 8. So how is Rabbi Ezer ben Hyrcanus an outsider? Basically, the story goes that at age 22 or 28, depends on the version of Avot Rabbi Natan you have, he decides that he wants to learn Torah. So that should sound, you know, like a dinging in your head. Oh, like Rabbi Akiva, he decided he wanted to learn when he was 40. So if the shiur was another 45 minutes long, we get the second part, which is Rabbi Akiva versus Rabbi Ezer. It's really interesting. It's really fun. We won't do that now, but keep that in the back of your mind. If it's meaningful to you, it'll give another layer to this year. So at age 22 or 28, he decides he wants to learn Torah. He's never learned anything before. He actually lives on this nice estate. His father, Hyrcanus, is a wealthy guy, and he's just been working, you know, his father's estate. He hasn't ever engaged in Torah learning before. And he decides he wants to learn Torah, and he decides he wants to go learn Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So his father says, "You can't learn Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Who do you think you are? You've never learned Torah before." You know, just all the disparaging things you can think of. And he says, "I'm going to disinherit you if you go." And he goes anyway. And it says that actually he went, he didn't have any food, maybe he like had to eat some dirt. And he gets there, he like so devoted, he sits there, he has no money, so he's eating dirt, is what the Midrash tells us. And it says that he starts to have a bad smell. And then Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai notices, you know, this student is sitting in front of him. Nobody knows who he is, and he smells really bad. So he thinks, is anybody taking care of this guy? Who is this guy? So he asks around. One version is that he asked two of his students to, you know, have him over, two of the other students that were in the Mishnah that we just read, and they have him over, and they make him not smell anymore. This version actually is really nice muster because he tells the students, "Are you having them over?" And they're like, "No, we thought you were having him over." And he says, "I thought you were having him over." So it's a nice like piece of muster that you should always, you know, take things upon yourself and make sure things are happening. Because if you just let that think that someone else is going to do it, it's not going to happen, and you're going to lose this chesed opportunity. So I actually like this version for that reason. This is a nice idea. So they realize that nobody's taking care of him. They invite him in. They make him, you know, come for whatever. And then lo and behold, he becomes this amazing Torah scholar who also doesn't smell anymore. So, which is a nice little piece of gravy, I guess, for him. I also wanted to add that actually in the version that I didn't bring, Eliyahu actually tells him, he's like a little bit lost on the way. Should I go? Should I not go? And Eliyahu's like, "Go, do it, do it." So it's always nice when Eliyahu like makes an appearance to, you know, set things along. So he becomes this big Torah scholar. He's sitting in front of his father. This version has it that his father comes and hears Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai speak. But the other version actually has it that Rabbi Ezer is teaching in front of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, in front of his teacher, and his teacher praises him. And at that moment, obviously, when his father chooses to come and confront his son, so Hyrcanus is in the Beit Midrash about to confront his son, and he sees that, you know, his son is this amazing Torah scholar, and he's like, "Oh, you can get your inheritance back. I take it all back. I didn't mean it." And then Rabbi Ezer ben Hyrcanus, in a, you know, very cool way, I guess, he's like, "I don't want it. This is my portion. I don't want your inheritance." And that's the end of the story. So we see clearly this outsider literally, you know, smells, like that's how much of a, you know, outsider he is, that he's sort of repelling people with his own scent. So he's an outsider, but he quickly, through his intelligence, becomes an insider. He becomes part of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's circle of students. Now we see in this next Avot Rabbi Natan, I actually want to read this inside because it's really fundamental to the point I'm going to make at the end. So basically we have this is in Nusach Bet. There's more than one version of Avot Rabbi Natan. Again, if you want a nice like academic shiur about Avot Rabbi Natan, you came to the wrong place. Different shiur, different person. Interesting topic. Okay, Amar lo Rabbi, so this is source 9. Amar lo Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Eliezer omer lanu davar echad mi divrei Torah. So Rabbi Yochanan says to his student, "Tell me some words of Torah." What a nice little scene that the teacher wants to hear from the student. Amar lo em sholach mashal lema ani domeh lebor zesh in yechol hotzi mayim yoter mima shehu mechnis. Okay, so he goes back to that image that we already set up, that he's a plastered well that's closed, and he says, I'm going to tell you, mashal, what am I? I'm like a well that, you know, takes water, but I can't give out anything that hasn't come inside the water. So this metaphor, just to get outside the metaphor for a second, is basically that he can learn a lot, and he'll teach what he learned, but he cannot teach something which he has not already learned from someone else. And we'll see that explicitly in the Gemara. But then Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says back to him, Amar lo em shalach mashal, lamaha devar doma, le be'er hazot shia mazal moti maya me'alea, kach atayachol amar divrei Torah, yoter mimash amar Moshe le'sinai. This is big stuff over here. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, like I said, he was an innovator. You're waiting for the proof. Here's the proof. He tells his student who just said, I cannot teach anything with someone I haven't gotten the Masorah that I haven't learned. And he says, no, you actually should be like a well or a spring. Actually, a spring is a better word that, you know, takes in water and also lets out water. And how should you do that? You can say Torah, which is yoter, more than what was said from Moshe at Har Sinai. So that, what is more innovative than that? And he's not saying, like, come up with something new. I think he thinks everything that he says, everything Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, was either thought about at Sinai or had in mind at Sinai that he would say it later. Not that it's totally made up, but that it's not something that was explicitly said at Har Sinai. You could say that. That's big. Amar le bet v'gimel pamim v'lo kibela, but, and he told this to his student Rabbi Eliezer many times, and Rabbi Eliezer didn't accept it. He was just not having it. Yet, sorry, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, v'halach lo. Okay, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai leaves, and now he misses this amazing moment. V'haya Rabbi Eliezer doresh tvarim yoter mimash ne'amar Moshe b'Sinai. So this is like, I think of it as a Picasso moment, where people go to the moment, they see Picasso, and like, oh my God, why is this guy, he's no talent. And the thing that I always say, maybe because I was an art history major, so I'm biased, but I always say, Picasso could do everything that you like. He could make a classical painting. He could do all of those things, and there's proof that he could do it, but he didn't want to. There must be a reason why he did, you know, these type of paintings, these modern paintings. So Rabbi Eliezer could be Doresh more than what was said at Sinai. He was able to. That's what we just said. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai left, and then he did it. He was Doresh more than what was said at Sinai. So why doesn't he? Because he fundamentally disagrees with that premise. It's not that he can't do it. It's not that he's not smart enough. It's that he disagrees with that idea. He thinks you should only teach what you have gotten in the Masorah, nothing new. And it actually says at the end that his face lit up, and it had like the Karen that Moshe had when he came down from Har Sinai. So it's very poetic. Okay, so again, we're setting up this idea that Rabbi Eliezer ben Zakkai is a really staunch traditionalist. Tradition is the most important thing to him. Something that wasn't in the Shoshalet, it doesn't matter. Okay, so here's another two Gemaras that we're going to use to emphasize this point. In Brachot, Rabbi Eliezer is quoted as saying, you know, a few things which cause the Shechina to go away from Israel, to lose the Shechina. And the last one he says is someone who says something in the name of his rabbi, which he did not hear directly from his rabbi, or it could be translated as someone who says something, not like that he heard it from his rabbi, doesn't quote his rabbi, but he didn't hear it from his rabbi and who says it. So that's an important distinction, but both are emphasizing the importance of you hear it from, you know, you heard it from Moshe, and Moshe then gave it to Yeshua, and you know, that really important line, and if you, you know, leave out who told it to you, you're implying, what are you implying? That you said it. And that implies that if you say something, it has authority, there's some, you know, it has legitimacy. And he disagrees with that premise. It has to be said by our teacher for it to be legitimate. In Chagiga, we have the most dramatic expression of that until we get to our Gemara, which is going to be the most dramatic because that's why it's the focus of our shir. So we're in Chagiga. I actually left out the first line, which is probably the most important line, which is that Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus was missing in Beit Midrash one day, and he asks his friend, what was the chiddush that they taught in the Beit Midrash today, ironically, because he doesn't think that you can have a chiddush. He doesn't think you can have chiddush, meaning like innovation. So he's saying it kind of ironically, well, what chiddush was in the Beit Midrash today? Not that there can be a chiddush, but what was there if there could be? And he actually is answered, so he's speaking to Rabbi Yossi, and he actually is answered, actually there was this big, you know, debate today. And what was the debate? Basically, we don't need to get into the weeds of this, but the debate is about whether Ammon and Moab are part of Eretz Yisrael in regards to Shemitah. You have to keep Shemitah and Ammon and Moab in those territories. And if you don't have to keep Shemitah, then you have to give Maser Ani. So just, we're not going to go into why and whatever. Just understand that, basically. premise. And they weren't sure, and he says, we took a vote, a majority rules, no Shemitah. Give Maser Ani. And Rabbi Eliezer, it says he start, first it says actually, Pashat, this is the bottom, I think we're on page 3 or 4, source 11. It says actually, he causes, this is not going to be the only miracle that Rabbi Eliezer performs, he causes Rabbi Yossi's eyes to fall out of his face. And he starts to cry, Bacha, he starts to cry, and he says, you know, the secret of God is only for those who fear them and those who know him, and he's so upset. And he says the, you know, really powerful words, "Al tachashu l'min yanechem." Do not be concerned. Don't think about your count, that your count is important, that because you had this majority rules, because three people, one person more, thought that Ammon and Moab were not part of Eretz Yisrael, that's why it's right. Don't think that, that you guys could just decide now, after there's already been a tradition, you guys could just decide now what you think by taking a vote. Don't think that. But, you know, rest assured that actually you were right, because I have a Masorah. He says, Kach mikablenu mirabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, sheshmarim rabo, v'rabo mirabo hilchata l'moshe misinai. I think it's so significant that it doesn't, that the Gemara does not always say, you know, I got it from this person, got it from this person, got it from this person. It just says, I got it from this one person. So it's really significant. He says, mirabo, v'rabo, mirabo, hilchata l'moshe misinai. He's really emphasizing the fact, it's not just Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai told it to me. It's our, someone told it to him. And someone told it to him. And someone told it to him. And then that came from Moshe Misinai. It's not Doresh Yoter Mimasha Moshe Misinai. That was more than from Moshe at Sinai. It's exactly from that time. So don't be worried that you had this count. The reason that you're right is not because of the count, not because of majority rules. It's because actually this was a tradition. And then basically he decides, you know, I'll spare you, and he gives the guy his eyes back. So that's the story. So what we walk away with is, again, this fundamental idea that Chazal had an idea, majority rules, which again is against the literal translation of the Pasuk. And they decided that that takes primacy over the most logical legal argument. Two people could have, maybe not a terrible argument because they're Chazal, so their arguments are probably good, but they could have a weak argument. And one person can have the strongest argument in the world, could be right. A Baskel could come down and say they were right, and they're still wrong. The halacha is still like the majority. And we're going to see Tanor Shachnai, that is the case. So if you heard Baskel comes down and something started ringing, it's probably because you recognize this Gemara in some form or another. It might have come up. So we're going to go through this Gemara. I think we still have some time. Okay, so we're going to read this Gemara, and that's going to be the last point of discussion for us. So the bottom of page 5, I don't know why mine didn't come out with numbers. It should be source 12 on the very bottom. There's just like super long safari thing. So if you're interested in the ins and outs of Shemitah and Ammon and Moav, you can read that, pursue that on your own. Okay. So I call this the boiling point because I think this is really where all the themes that we've been developing so far, the idea of majority rules, the innovation of Yavne, the fact that Rabbi Eliezer is very resistant to those innovations and is very much a traditionalist. He's the plastered well that doesn't let anything new in. So, or, you know, really more like he doesn't let anything new out. He won't come up with his own Torah. So all of those things really come to a head in this Gemara, Tanur Shel Achnai. So we have sort of that this is going to be the tension point between Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, between innovation, between the spring that flows out new water, and Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus and the plastered well, and being, you know, just with the tradition. So I want to read it all inside, and we'll develop the themes as we go. So the first, let's read the first piece, and I'll explain what the idea is behind here. Tanu tnan hatam chatchu chaliyo menatan cho bein chulia lechulia. So again, we're on the source 12, so at the bottom here, this is what it looks like. So I should follow along if we're going to read out loud. Okay, so here's the case. And we really don't have to understand the case. We do not. This is going to be a Tumantara thing, which we do not have to understand the themes that I'm talking about here. So don't worry if you get freaked out by Tumantara and how it's very complicated. I don't understand it myself. So we have an earthenware oven. It's cut into pieces, and the pieces are put together with sand. And the question is, can that become impure, or is it pure or impure? Can it be mekabel tumah or not. So Rabbi Yezer said, Rabbi Yezer mitaher v'chachamim mitamin. Rabbi Yezer says it's pure, and the chachamim say it's impure. That's a machloket. Don't get any more concerned about the tumah and tahara. Just know that Rabbi Yezer says pure, chachamim say impure. V'zehu tanur shalachnai, and this is the case of tanur shalachnai. My achnai, what is an achnai? Amar of Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, shekfu dvarim ka'achna zo v'tamehu. So an achnai is a snake, so it's a metaphor. They surrounded Rabbi Yezer like a snake with their words and made the oven impure. So it's a metaphor. Don't get overly concerned about why the story is called Tanur Shel Achnai, but if you ever hear someone refer to it, now you know why. And we'll get to probably the part that you have heard of later. Okay. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Tzna ba'oto hayom, heshiv Rabbi Yezer, kol tshuvot shuvo olam, in the next page, below kiblu haimino. So Rabbi Yezer, who's arguing against the majority, it says he gave all the answers in the world, literally it says all the answers in the world, so it's very, you know, hyperbolic, and they did not accept any of his logic from him. So before we go any further, just to emphasize that point, Rabbi Yezer is obviously in the minority, one person versus Chachamim, which is obviously multiple people. So it doesn't matter why he thinks it's pure, because he loses. So clearly we already see that he is rejecting, as before, he's rejecting the principle of majority rules. So in any other debate that we might have, it would have been the end. Rabbi Meir says this, Chachamim say that, in the end, they don't, you know, have this huge debate that's going to become this really weird Gemara. It just ends, because the majority rules, you rule like the majority, the end. But Rabbi Yezer does not accept that principle. Because what does that principle say, just to reiterate? It's saying that this rule of Chazal can uproot something that might be, you know, let's say true, like we were saying. It is 1/10 of a chance that's not kosher. But the power of Chazal is to override that 1/10 chance that we know is true. We know that there's 1/10 chance that it's not kosher, and say it is kosher. That's a huge power. So it's not surprising that someone who is against the innovation of halacha, who's a very staunch traditionalist, would say, that's not how it works. It doesn't work like majority rules. It doesn't work that you can override, you know, halachic, you know, good reasons, good arguments, and just say whoever has the most people on their side wins. And that determines the halacha. So it shouldn't be surprising that, you know, he's still going at it, even though he's in the minority. So let's keep going, because he keeps going. Amar lahem, im halacha kamoti, charuv zo yochiach. Nakar charuv mimikomo, mea ama, v'amri la arba ma'ot ama. Okay, v'amru lo, ein mivian raya min hacharuv. So here's the first miraculous thing that he tries to do. Like we already saw, he clearly has miracles up his sleeve with the eyeballs in the person's hand. So he says, this carob tree is going to prove it for me. This carob tree then uproots itself 100 amot. And some say 400 amot. And they tell him, sorry, we don't paskin halacha like carob trees. I don't care if the carob tree or some, you know, it's clear some effort from Shemayim is showing us that your logical reason for why you made the oven pure is, you know, is sort of defending you. Is the carob tree is uprooting itself to say, see, Rabbi Lezer was right. The carob tree can move because he is right. And they say, sorry, be possible like majority rules, not like miracles from carob trees. What's the next thing he's going to tell us? Chazar v'amar lahem, im halacha kamoti, amad hamayim yochichu. Chazru amad hamayim l'achrahem. Amru lo, ein mevi'in ra'a me'amad hamayim. So then there's a stream. He says, this stream is going to prove it for me. The stream starts flowing in the opposite direction that was just flowing. And they say, sorry, we don't paskin like streams. And now again, Chazar amar lahem, im halacha kamoti, koloti, beit hamidrash yochichu. Hatu koloti, Beit Midrash Lipol. Ga'ar behem Rabbi Yeshua. Amar lahem, im tamidei chachamim menatzchim zeh et zeh b'halacha, atem ma tivchem. Lo niflu mipnei kvodo shel Rabbi Yeshua, v'lo zekfu mipnei kvodo shel Rabbi Yezer. Va'adayin mat'in v'omdim. Okay, so this is the last of the little miracles before we get to the famous one. Basically, he says the Beit Midrash is going to prove, the walls of the Beit Midrash are going to prove that I am right. And the walls of the Beit Midrash start to fall. And then another one of Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai's students, Rabbi Yeshua, says, What are you doing, Walls? It's none of your business. You know, if two rabbis are arguing with each other, what is it your business to get involved and prove that one is right over the other? And then the Walls stop. So they're kind of like this. Like they were like this. And then he stops them. And it says they wouldn't go back like this out of kavod for Eliezer, but they wouldn't totally fall out of kavod for Yeshua. So they're kind of stuck in the middle. And now we have the most famous one. But actually, before I get there, there's some symbolism here that I want to explore instead of going backwards. It's right here. The symbolism here, as we've already established, Rabbi Eliezer is concerned about, you know, preserving the Torah, and he's worried. What's he worried about with this innovation? What is at stake? You know, I think it's funny when like the rabbis and the Gemara kind of get really sharp with each other and say really mean things to each other. And on the one hand, you could say like, oh, they have no kavod haTorah. You know, where's their kavod haBriyot? That's true. I wouldn't start insulting my chavrusa on a day-to-day basis. But I think there is something about how much they cared. They really cared about what they were talking about. Doesn't make it okay. Don't leave the share saying Mindy told you to insult your chavrusa, please. But I'm just trying to emphasize the idea that there's something really real here. That's really at stake for them. That I think maybe, at least in my life, I don't feel really day to day. But they're determining the halacha for these people. They're setting things in stone. And that, you know, really has some weight to it. And he really feels, Rabbi Eliezer, that the innovations of Yavna are going too far. That something wrong is happening to this Mesorah that he cares so much about. That he ate dirt for. This is very real to him. So what do these three miracles symbolize here? So the first was the uprooting of a tree. So Eitz Chaim, so the Torah is a tree. He's saying, Yavna, you are uprooting the Mesorah. You know, if you think about it, like a big oak tree that's very sturdy, it has roots. So that's the Mesorah to him. It's something that has roots. It's not, you know, just something you stuck in the ground. So that's the first one. The second is the water. Again, Torah is water. That's another comparison. So it's the same thing. The stream starts going backwards. So we're saying, you cannot, you know, you're taking, we were kind of going in this forward direction on the Shalshelet. Forward not in a, you know, progress, innovation sense. Forward in a sense of, you tell one tells us one, and you keep going like that, as opposed to, you know, you go here and you go there and you go there, and everyone just says their own thing and there's no one continuous line. You're going to send the stream backwards, so we're going to lose it. That's the water. And the last one is, I think, the most obvious, is the Beit Midrash. So the halls of study are falling in. He thinks they're literally destroying the Torah. They're tearing down the Beit Midrash with their innovation. So those are the, you know, nice three symbolisms. Actually, in the spirit of Rabbi Eliezer, I should say that this idea here is, I learned it from Rav Tani Feintuck at Migdalo, so sorry I didn't say that earlier. And he's very good at reading these, you know, metaphors and symbolism into the Midrash, so I would recommend looking him up on BBM. Okay, so let's keep going in the Gemara. This is probably the most famous part. This might, if you've learned any part of this, is definitely this part. Okay, Va'adayin Matin Vodim, that was the Beit Midrash, is still like this. Chazar V'amar Lehem, we're, you know, about halfway in on source 12. Chazar V'amar Lehem, Im Halacha Kamoti, Min Shamayim Yochichu, Yatzta Batkov Amra Malachem, Eitz Rabbi Yazar, Shalacha Kamoto, Bekol Makom. Amad Rabbi Yeshua, Araglav Amar, Lo B'Shamayim Hi. Here's the title of our shir. My lo b'shamayim hi, amar Rabbi Yirmiya shekfar natsna Torah mehar Sinai, ein anu mashkichin bebat kol. Shekfar katav tebar Sinai, Torah achrei rabim lahatot. Okay, so let's unpack that. That was a lot. So first, Rabbi Eliezer says, if the halacha is like me, the heavens will prove it. And out comes a bat kol and says, what are you guys doing? Rabbi Eliezer is right all the time. This is all every person's dream, that someone will just come down and tell everyone, you know, that you're always right. And comes down and says, Rabbi Eliezer is always right. And right away, Rabbi Yeshua, who we already saw as the defender with the Beit Midrash, right away he gets back and he says, no, not Bash, we don't, lo b'shamayim hi, the Torah is not in heaven, the Torah is on earth. We do not paskin like a bat kol, because a bat kol is from heaven. We paskin like what has been decided on earth. And then Rabbi Yirmiyah explained, what does that mean? What does it mean, Lo Bashamayim? Why did he say that? It sounds really nice, and it's something that, it's probably if you've heard anything about Lo Bashamayim here, and, you know, not passing like a baskol, it's really nice. But what does it mean literally in this context? Lo Bashamayim, he's so. So Rabbi Yirmiyah gives us that so. He says, the Torah already wrote at Sinai, Achrei Rabim Lahatot. And let's finish the sentence knowing what we know about that rule. And Chazal on earth decided that that meant majority rules. So it's interesting because he says, it said at Har Sinai, Echri Rabim Lahatot. What did it really say at Har Sinai? It said, Lo Echri Rabim Lahatot. It said, don't go after the majority. But it was given, we believe that there was a power for Chazal, that they had this power to understand the Torah, even against its literal meaning. And I didn't say this before, but I should have, but this isn't the only time. Probably the most famous time is Ayin Tachat Ayin, which is a fundamental principle that we believe, is that the Torah did not actually mean that when you know, if you took out someone's eye, we're going to take out your eye. I think it's definitely part of the way we see Judaism as not a religion that does that, that doesn't cut people's hands off or, you know, stealing and things like that. We don't do that kind of thing. Well, the Torah says we do, but Chazal interpreted that as meaning, figuratively, if you take out someone's eye, you have to pay the value of an eye. So, ayin tachat ayin means the value of an eye for an eye, not an eye for an eye. So, it shouldn't be so surprising. Like, don't leave a shir and have... stay awake at night wondering why does Chazal do that, or do stay awake but know that it happens more than once, that Chazal have this power to go against the literal meaning. You know, there's four levels of how to read a pasuk. There's drat, there's drash, kabbalah, you know, there's pshat. There's 70 faces to the Torah. There's a lot of different ways to understand the Torah. And Chazal were given that power to interpret it the way that they saw fit. It was given. So Lo Bashamayim, he means it was in heaven. God gave it to Moshe at Sinai. He gave it to the people, the shalot of rabbis, and they have the power to interpret it the way that they see fit. But who fundamentally disagrees with that opinion? Rabbi Yezer, that's not what he thinks. He thinks the Torah is given at Sinai, it has the shalot, and anything, they don't have the power to, you know, make these new rules, go against what was determined before. They can't do that. They can't just say majority rules. So even though, Rabbi Yezer, you clearly are right about this principle, and you have the shalot of Mesorah, majority rules, so we don't go against, so we go against you? I think the story wants you to sympathize with Rabbi Yezer, even though, you know, he does not come out on top of the story. There are two proofs for that. One is, I think, the fact that the Bakul literally says he's right. So I think everyone can have that experience of being like, I'm right, I know I'm right, and everyone thinks you're wrong. And like, I think we can all relate to that experience. So I think there's something very relatable about what he's going through. And the second piece is actually that this Gemara is taught in the context of speaking badly about people. And, you know, causing harm with your words. That's actually why it's in Bav Metzia, because there's this little section about speaking badly. Onas Dvarim, and this is in the context of Onas Dvarim, actually. And we'll see at the end why. So, Rabbi Yezer is actually the victim here, as painted by, whoever set up the Gemara, in that context, in the Onas Dvarim context. So it definitely wants us to sympathize with Rabbi Yezer. But we also, I think, what do we usually quote? We usually quote the other side, which is Lo Bashamayim, that the Torah is on heaven, and that's very empowering. It feels good. It does feel good. So I think, I don't want you to leave, you know, one side or the other. I want us to appreciate both sides. Lo Bashamayim is very empowering. It does feel good that we don't just say, we're just waiting for Bakos to come around and resolve all our debates. It's not even a functional system. It doesn't really make sense. But I think more than anything, majority rules is a practical rule. It's very practical. So let's get things done. Let's resolve things. Let's not wait for Rabbi Yezer ben Hyrcanus to come down with a baskol. But on the other hand, you can sympathize with the fact that Rabbi Yezer ben Hyrcanus was right, and he, you know, kind of lost. He lost even though he was right. That's a frustrating experience. So now let's just keep going, but now that we can appreciate that little exchange, so Lo Bashamayim he, it's not in heaven, we don't care what the baskol says, we rule like the majority. That's what Chazal decided. And now you see Ishkacha Rabbi Natan Eliyahu. This is very poetic, this piece. Amar Lei, my Avid HaKadosh Baruch Hu Bahahi Shata. Okay, so Rabbi Natan, afterwards, he finds Eliyahu. Eliyahu comes back. He's always around at the funnest times. And Rabbi Natan says, what did Hashem think, or what did he look like at this moment? What was going on? Like, what? It's a good question. You know, sometimes you wonder, like, where was God at this moment or that moment? He wants to know at this fundamental moment where we decided, Lo Bashamayim, he was very dramatic. We went with what you know, we went with what the Chachamim decided over this bat kol. So what was God thinking? Amar le kachayecha v'amar nischuni banai. Hashem was smiling and he was saying, my children have defeated me, my children have defeated me. It's very poetic. It really is like that. I think it was a movie, where Shakespeare goes to college and he doesn't understand anything in the Shakespeare class. And it's like, you know, it's a comedy. So it kind of reminds me of that. It's like God is kind of laughing. He's like, yeah, like they've defeated me. Clearly, the Bas Kol representative of God is saying, Rabbi Ezer is right. And they've come up with this halachic system which has defeated me. But he's smiling. He's not saying, oh, like they actually defeated me, they uprooted my Torah. He's smiling. He's saying they use these legal principles, which they had the right to do, which they were empowered to do, in order to defeat me, quote unquote, because they're saying it's not in heaven anymore. Now it's on earth, and we have that power. So it's like kind of poetic. I've heard it interpreted as almost like as sad, but I think the fact that he's smiling means that it's sort of, he's like happy, kind of laughing about it. It's almost like a smirk. More than anything else, I think it's kind of like, oh, they're so clever. My children are so clever that they have defeated me. Like if you kind of can weasel, like your parents say something, you kind of weasel your way, you kind of trick them a little bit, and they're like, oh, like you bested me. You know, they're smirking, you know, like you're proud because your kid is really smart, but you're annoyed because, you know, whatever. You kind of have both emotions at the same time. Okay, and what's the last piece? Amru oto hayom heviu kol taro shetir aliyazer v'sarfan be'esh v'nimnu alav v'barchuhu. So barchuhu here is not actually they gave him the bracha, it actually means that they excommunicated him. So this is why it's in the context of Onas Devarim, because the Gemara is telling us actually that they went too far. This is what happens. They say, we don't paskin like Rabbi Ezer, we don't paskin like Bakos, we paskin like majority rule, so the oven is then impure. But they go further than that. Because Rabbi Eliezer, clearly we go against him, you know, in this pure, impure debate, it must be that everything he says is pure, is impure, and then burn it all. Burning because it's earthenware, so there's nothing you can do with it, so they burn it. So, and then they excommunicate him. And it's this very, you know, unfortunate, sad thing. And actually the Gemara, if you keep going in his life story again, if you have another 45 minutes, we go into Rabbi Kiva, and there's a lot more here. But basically he ends up, you know, totally alone, dies alone, really separated from the tradition that, you know, he was such a defender of. So it's kind of a sad postscript, is that... Yeah, so I think the Gemara, because it's in the context of Onatz Varem, which means, you know, hurting people with your word, so the fact that they excommunicated him and also burnt everything that he made pure, so it's very extreme, you know, really kind of just saying, we don't go by anything that you say, anything that you do. So they're saying that...
They don't, you know, reprimand them for doing that?
So the...
That they did that? Because that's clearly wrong.
Yeah, no, so the Gemara is saying, here's an example of Onas Devarim, and then it tells us the story. I didn't bring that part because it's, like, tangential. There's, like, other examples, and it says, and here's another example. So it doesn't say it explicitly. It's just, you know, because they're giving, here's a list of Onas Devarim, X, Y, and then it brings this story. Appropriate to that topic of Onas Devarim, here's this story. So it's down to the reader to see that the fact that they did this to him, and then they excommunicated him, and they, you know, completely cut him off, because they did that, they did something wrong. But it's not saying, emphasis on this point, that the halacha was wrong. It's saying that the words, the actions, the interpersonal relationship was wrong. How they treated him was wrong. But again, nischuni banai, they were actually right about the way that, you know, they went about passing the halacha. So I guess just a takeaway. Sorry, it kind of ends on a really sad note, isn't it? If you keep it or if you keep it in there, it's a little bit happier. But I think the takeaway is just to appreciate these two schools of thought, you know, just to understand a little bit more what is at stake. Why are they arguing? What did Rabbi Eliezer lose when he lost this argument? And I think it's also nice to understand Lo Bashamayim Hi. I think that's really quoted all the time. And I think it's nice to really appreciate what that means, because we do say it a lot. And I think it's nice to appreciate the other side. I think when you can appreciate the other side, you actually appreciate the Chachamim more. When you appreciate the counterpoint, it makes the point stronger. It's like, you know, it's better to have opposition. It makes, you know, the majority stronger. So I think it's good to appreciate, you know, Rabbi Eliezer's side, whether or not we hold like him, because it helps you understand your point more. It makes, when you understand kind of the drawbacks of majority rules or the drawbacks of this innovation, I think it makes you appreciate the innovation more. So that's why I really like this Gemara, why I really like learning this Machloka, because I think it just helps us appreciate that give and take between the Chachamim and Yavne, which was such a fruitful, you know, blossoming time for Torah scholarship, and it's just an exciting time. And I'm sorry that it was a sad story. So maybe next time, if I ever come back, I'll share a happier story. Okay, thank you.